I'm Emily Tackett, and this is Just So, an OU podcast about thought leaders here in the heartland. There's a world of voices on this campus, but there's only one Oklahoma. We spend exorbitant amounts of money and time engaging in imaginary worlds, consuming movies, books, TV series, video games. We're emotionally invested in fictional characters that don't exist, and we genuinely care about fake people living imaginary lives in imaginary worlds.
I actually once did a calculation about the Harry Potter series, and the most conservative estimate you can get for the amount of time people have spent on Harry Potter means that one person could have sat around from the dawn of man until now, doing nothing but reading and watching Harry Potter 24 hours a day, and that still wouldn't be the amount of time that people have actually spent on Harry Potter in the real world.
That was Dr. Jennifer Barnes, our guest for today. She's a professor with a dual appointment at OU. That means she spends half her time teaching courses in professional writing and half her time in the psychology department.
So I have this really unusual dual life where I spend half my time writing fiction and half my time studying why it is that we care so much about fictional characters, why it is that we spend so much time and money and emotion on things we know aren't real.
On top of all that, she's also published several novels with Disney and Random House. She also writes TV pilots for shows on USA and MTV.
Disney is actually my book publisher now. So my big series with Disney right now that I just wrapped up is called The Naturals. It's sort of a teenage Criminal Minds or NCIS.
Feels like you're kind of just living my dream life, what I want to do.
It's pretty much my dream life too. So it's really amazing to get to do it.
So as humans, we spend a remarkable amount of time engaging in these fictional worlds. Even though they aren't real. So my first question is, why do we do that? Why do humans like fake
that
worlds?
That is the million-dollar question for psychologists especially interested in the psychology of fiction. So why is it that we don't grow out of make-believe? You know, we stop playing pretend the way little kids do. We don't believe in the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus, but we're still willing to spend billions of dollars and untold man-hours on all of these things that aren't real. So this question of why in the world are we spending all of this time and getting emotionally involved and upset and feel personally betrayed when an author kills a character and all these things. So why does this happen? And there are lots of theories about why this happened. Some of the theories take an evolutionary perspective, and they basically say, why is it that our minds would be wired to care about stories? And those theories tend to fall in one of two camps.
One of those camps is called byproduct theories, which are theories that basically say humans like fiction as a byproduct of something else that we are actually evolutionarily wired to like, or that was evolutionary advantageous to us at some time.
For example, my favorite byproduct theory is that a liking for fiction is a byproduct of an innately wired liking for gossip. So it is advantageous to us to keep track of the reputations and relationships of other people we actually interact with in our society. And the idea here is that gossip or fiction is essentially just gossip about people who happen not to be real. And you can actually look out there and you look at television show names and that you have names like Scandal. Like, and Gossip Girl, yeah. Right? And you've got all of these things where you're like, okay, it seems like a large percentage of what we like about fiction may actually be the same kinds of things that if it was happening in the real world, we'd want to read about in People magazine, or if it was happening, you know, in your college classes or in your dorm, you'd want to gossip with people about those relationships and the hierarchies and the alliances and, you know, sex and death and all of these things that people actually really care about in the real world. So that's one side of it.
Another theory is that storytelling actually helped us survive. That idea is that in the environment where we evolved, people who were wired to like stories survived better and reproduced better than those who didn't.
How could spending time on something that's not real make us survive better in reality? And there are a variety of different theories on that ground as well, but probably one of the most prominent these days is that fiction, the function of fiction, is that it sort of allows us to practice understanding social situations and other people. Broader view is that fiction just helps us to learn in general. So we all have this catalog of experiences that we've had from which we've learned. And the idea is that some of those experiences that we've learned from aren't real experiences at all. They aren't things we've actually done or actually experienced. They're things we've only experienced through stories. And that specifically, a lot of what we're experiencing in stories is we're experiencing, you know, emotions and relationships and people with goals and obstacles coming in front of those goals and people with contrasting beliefs and desires. So that fiction is actually this sort of simulation of the mental or social world.
Dr. Barnes cited a paper by Raymond Marn and Keith Oatley called "The Function of Fiction is the Abstraction and Simulation of Social Simulations." Basically saying, when we read a book or watch a movie, what's going on is that we're in this simulated world where we can practice attributing mental states, emotions, and motivations to other people and ourselves. And that maybe engaging with fiction this way helps us respond better to situations in reality too. What has to happen in the human brain so that we feel powerful and authentic sympathy or stress for characters that don't exist? Like, you were talking about Harry Potter. I was inconsolable when I thought Harry Potter had died. And what is going on when I'm mourning for a fake person?
I can't speak to the neuroscience specifically because I am not a neuroscientist. But this is definitely a question I ask myself all the time as a writer. You know, I want to write characters that people care about. That they get emotionally invested in. You know, occasionally I'll kill a character and I always feel really successful when I get the email sent to my inbox, all caps, like, how could you? You know, why have you made me suffer in this way? I feel horrible for making people suffer, but at the same time, I'm like, yes, you cared about that character. But from a psychological perspective, this, what is it that people can do to make us care about the character is a huge and somewhat open question. We know some of the things that seem to operate. So for instance, identification seems to matter. So we tend to care about characters if we can see a piece of ourself in them somehow. There's also another construct referred to as a parasocial interaction, which can lead to a parasocial relationship. And these relationships are relationships we have with people we don't actually know. So you can form one with a celebrity, or a politician, or a fictional character, right? So they're people that we only know because we consume media about them, but you feel like you know them.
Yes. When I talk about fictional characters or celebrities as if I know them around my husband, he acts like I'm a crazy person and to his core believes that he's not susceptible to feeling these parasocial relationships, which is loosely related to some other awesome research that you do on imaginative resistance. We have this huge capacity to imagine things. The possibilities are basically endless. But at the same time, there are things that people can't imagine or don't want to. Can you talk about that?
One of my graduate students, Jessica Black, and I actually did a bunch of empirical experiments in the lab on imaginative resistance, looking at what people can and cannot imagine. And we found a few things. One, some people don't really experience imaginative resistance, and they can imagine alternate moralities and alternate worlds and all of these things. And some people experience it very strongly. They experience it not just as being unwilling to imagine those things, but they're unable to imagine those things. And they'll tell you that those things are actually as impossible as 2 + 2 = 5. Like, they're just not possible. So there's great individual differences in this. But one of the things that we're interested in, and one of the theories of imaginative resistance, is that in some sense, you're kind of resisting the author. And one reason that we might do it with specifically moral things, like sometimes have that moral check on a story, is because we feel like the author is trying to change our morality in some ways. So fiction has this incredible capacity for potentially changing the way we view the world in both subtle and dramatic ways. But if you have the idea that an author is trying to do that, there might be this protective check that comes and says, no, I'm not going to play. If you know that someone is trying to change the way that you're trying to think, or that you think, you might decide not to let them do that. And it's very easy to decide that you're not going to let a piece of fiction change you because you just decide not to play along, right? You don't ever let yourself get transported in. You don't ever care about the characters enough to let it do these things. So one thing we're really interested in my lab, we have these two different areas of research, because we've looked at how fiction affects your ability to understand the minds of others. And we've looked at imaginative resistance and what people can and cannot and are and are not willing to imagine. And we're interested in bringing those two together and looking at this individual difference of imaginative resistance and seeing if resistance plays a role in fiction's ability to actually change us.
That's insane. And I know you have some really interesting research on our sense of fictional morality and how it's different than our real world morality in some cases. Why do we sometimes like fictional characters who are not moral when we probably wouldn't like them in real life?
We've got some interesting research going on in my lab right now that's actually created in part by two students we had from OU's FIRE program, which is the first year research experience program. So we had a variety of first years have come through the lab. So first year students in their first year of college get experience working in research labs. And two of our FIRE students last year came up with a study that they were going to design for themselves. They were working with my graduate student, Jessica Black, and she helped them to design the study. And what they were interested in was a liking for dark characters. So some people like heroes and some people go see Marvel movies and they're like, oh, Loki, you're like, you're my favorite. And so they were interested, what makes people like these sort of more villainous characters? So this is research that's still ongoing in my lab. We're still looking at these different kinds of things and seeing what it is that might predict it. But one thing that we've seen associated with that across a couple different experiments, including a new one conducted by my other graduate student, Brian Rudinger, is the personality trait of Machiavellianism. So it seems like some level of sort of the ends justifies the means. It's related to some, in some ways, being manipulative, but also being strategic. And just sort of looking at the best way of doing things and how to get there. And it seems that Machiavellianism in part predicts some of this liking for dark characters. And one of the things I think you often see when you have characters who are amoral or immoral, but people just love them, is those characters are often highly, highly competent. So oftentimes when you get a character who people might otherwise say is quote unquote unlikable, you like them because they're just so good at whatever it is they do, right? So you have the police detective who's immoral in a variety of ways, but gosh, is he good at catching criminals. Or the doctor in the vein of, you know, Gregory House from the show House, who's like kind of mean to people and, you know, uses people and is manipulative and everything. We see his softer sides too, of course, because that's what fiction does for us. But also, gosh, is he good at solving medical mysteries. So part of the reason that people may like some of these dark characters on television shows, like for instance, House of Cards, especially in the early seasons, is that they're just so good at being that Machiavellian, doing what it takes to get what they want, to see that goal fulfilled. And there's reasons to believe that one of the things we really like about fiction is seeing goals fulfilled, that we really like people who strive to do something, and it's fun to watch them do all of these different things. And then the other aspect of that is that, okay, if this person were real, you might feel bad about liking them, because then you would have to think about their victims and who they're harming and who they had to sacrifice to get what they wanted. But in fiction, you're kind of licensed to like them anyway, because it's like no real people were harmed in the making of these Machiavellian decisions, right? So in that case, you can sort of get to where you're like, oh, it's kind of guilt-free liking for this Machiavellian goal-achieving kind of thing, because even if they were mean to people or blackmailed someone or murdered someone, it wasn't a real person that was blackmailed and murdered and being mean to. It was a fictional person. So you can sort of get out some of these dark impulses or this desire to see competence at other costs without any real world moral downside.
Yes. And I love antiheroes. I think all, like, Superman doesn't really do anything for me. He's too good. I really do like more of a Batman kind of a character myself. And is that in playing out in a fictional world, getting to experiment with impulses that are darker or that you don't really want to admit that you may have?
I think it could be. But I also think there's some interesting phenomenon that we have to consider here. So the first step of the scientific method is always observation. So I have a million studies that I would like to do that I haven't run yet. So I haven't completed a scientific experiment on them. But I'm always in observation mode trying to get these. And one observation that a writing friend of mine once made is that, okay, imagine an opening scene of a novel. And imagine that your character is like an assassin who has just killed someone. And this story is going to be a redemption arc. People are willing to read and go along with the redeemed assassin, or at least some subset of people are. People very high in imaginative resistance, maybe not, but some other individuals, yes. But imagine that what they're being redeemed from is just being like a petty everyday jerk. Right? So imagine instead of killing someone in the opening act, I can't swear that this is who this came from, but I want to say that this came from author Holly Black. But that could just be because lots of pearls of wisdom come from young adult author Holly Black. But imagine that instead of killing someone in the opening chapter, that you saw them in a diner just kind of being a jerk to their waitress and then stiffing them and leaving them no tip and just all of these little petty things. Then do we want a redemption story for that person, right? You don't. So it seems in some ways that fictionally killing someone might be something that we can fictionally forgive, but fictionally kicking a dog or stiffing a waitress on her tip might not be. And I think this comes back in some ways. My theory would be that this comes back to the reasons that we believe writers include information in books. So if you used to be an assassin, that's relevant to the plot, most likely. It's relevant to your character, archetype, and all of these things. So we'll say, oh, well, of course he had to kill people. The writer made him kill people, you know, blah, blah, blah. If, on the other hand, we're showing someone being just really petty, and it obviously serves no plot purpose, there's no bigger reason for the writer to show it to you, then why is the writer showing it to you? Well, they're probably showing it to you because it is diagnostic deep down of who this person is. Because otherwise, why would the writer ever include such a small, petty, all of this thing? So my theory is that one of the reasons that we're able to forgive acts in fiction that we can't in reality is that the authors may be signaling to us, no, this is who this person really is. There's a screenwriting book by a guy named Blake Snyder, and the title of the book is Save the Cat. And that refers to one of his rules for writing screenplays, which is very early in your screenplay, your protagonist should have what he calls a save the cat moment. He says, he gives an example of someone actually saving a cat. So you're like, hardened assassin saves the cat. Then you're like, oh, he has to be an assassin for plot reasons, but who he is deep down is saving the cat. Right. So you see this action early on, some streak of heroism or something in some way that makes you think this person is redeemable.
Right. I remember I had an argument the other day in the office about Snape, and they were like, you know, like he got redeemed in the end. And I was like, it's not worth it. He made fun of Hermione's teeth when she was a little girl. Like, you just can't do that.
Yeah, you know, that's the pettiness that you can't be redeemed for. So like maybe he was redeemed for being a Death Eater. And, you know, they want you to believe, of course. Oh, I won't say what they want you to believe the reason he was doing that was, because that's kind of a spoiler. Even though Harry Potter has been out a long time, I will try not to spoil anyone for it.
How do adults and kids who frequently engage in imaginary worlds differ from those who don't?
There are a variety of at least suggestive correlational results. So this is looking at just a statistical associations between these two groups of people, like people who do more fiction and people who do less. And in my lab, we've actually looked at it in a more complicated way than that, because instead of just looking at, yes, they engage in fiction and no, they don't, we actually break it down by the genres of fiction that people are most likely to engage in. So there's an overall result that's been replicated many times in the literature, originally from Raymond Marr's research group, showing that people who engage with more fiction are better at certain performances on emotion reading tests. So they may be better at reading emotions and certain theory of mind tasks in the real world. That's been replicated as an association many times. And that does seem like it might break down by genre a little bit. There's some debate in the field whether it's just literary fiction that does it. There's some other evidence that suggests that romance fiction might be the one that's most associated with it. In our own lab, we've extended that to look at not just the association between reading fiction and your ability to think about others' minds, but we've actually looked at reading fiction and moral intuitions as well. And what we found is that there are certain genres of fiction that if you read more of are associated with a little more moral flexibility. Specifically, we gave participants a task where we would give them a really taboo or immoral action. It can range from, say, like kidnapping an infant to a brother kissing a sister, just a huge range of taboo and immoral actions. And then we ask, could this act ever be morally permissible? Yes or no. And what we find is that there are certain genres where if people read more in those genres, they're more likely to say, yes, maybe that could be morally permissible. So for example, the genres of fantasy and science fiction are associated with increased likelihood of sort of saying, yes, under some circumstances, this could be morally permissible. And part of our theory of what's going on here is that it might be driven by an ability to think about the world being other ways than the world currently is, right? Because so fantasy and science fiction, that's what it's all about. Those are genres defined by changing some key thing in the world. Something that's impossible in our world becomes possible in speculative fiction. And if you think about these moral judgments we ask people to make, one way that you could imagine that it could sometimes be okay, for instance, to kidnap an infant, is if you can come up with a circumstance in which that would be okay. So maybe it's almost always wrong to kidnap an infant, but what if you know the infant's parents are getting ready to kill him? Then all of a sudden it becomes very right to kidnap that infant. Right. So if you can think of sort of these counterfactual examples, if the world were different than I know it to be, then this could be okay. So some of that may be related to imagination, which may be some of what's going on and why we see fantasy and science fiction being these genres where people are more likely to say yes. For us, it was romance and mystery thriller. People were more likely to say no, that can never be morally permissible. We also have another study that my lab is working on right now that looks at exposure to those different fiction genres and beliefs about relationships. So how likely are you, for instance, to hold unrealistic beliefs about romantic relationships, specifically beliefs like disagreeing with your partner is destructive, or beliefs like your partner can't change. So it's more adaptive to believe that, oh, partners can work to change and that disagreement can be constructive and all of these different things. And again, we find certain genres are associated with increased realism in those beliefs. So again, the fantasy genre is a big one. Certain literary fiction genres are associated with that as well. So in general, what we see is there do seem to be a lot of differences and different associations with how people think about the social world. So how they understand the minds of others, how they think about morality, how they think about relationships, and that does seem to be a thing that varies somewhat between readers and non-readers, and also between readers of different genres.
Even though they don't exist, imaginary worlds entertain us, challenge our morality, and impact our lives in meaningful ways.
Thank you so much for joining me today and talking all about
your
research.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks for tuning in. Just So is produced by me, Emily Tackett, and Drew Bernard. He's actually right here in the studio with me. Do you want to add anything, Drew?
Yeah, video games are awesome.
Great addition. Our work is by Amy Azure. Our new logo is thanks to her. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and if you like our podcast, suggest it to a friend who may also appreciate conversations with college professors. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.